We're back today with Vid History Makers, with myself and Kevin Pham. And today we are going to go over the life of Pham Quinn. Welcome, everyone.
Welcome back. So I'm looking forward to this episode. Pham Quinn is a really complex figure. He's a puzzle. Here's what I mean. On the one hand, he is seen today as a savior of Vietnamese culture and language. But in the 1920s, he was seen as a collaborator with the French. The Viet Minh saw him as a traitor. They executed him once they took power in 1945. But today, he's somewhat of a hero in Vietnam. So why is that?
You know, I think that when I think about Pham Quinh and what you just said about changing tides and political adversaries who are put to death at one point and then becoming a hero, it kind of gives me hope for Vietnam's sort of future, because there's all of these different factors and factions, and hopefully people in the previous government, current government, people all around the diaspora might not be so punished, quote unquote, I mean, in the future history of Vietnam. So I think about Pham Quinh and his history, and I can't wait to really understand how that kind of, how the wind shifts and you become, you know, known as a martyr or somebody who is beloved by the country that, or the people that put you to death.
Yeah, this is a great question. The perception and the image of figures, historical figures, are always constantly being rewritten. And they're being rewritten for different purposes, right? For different reasons. That will become clear as we go on in this episode. So let's start. Let's start.
But before we start.
Yeah.
Before we start, I do want to, it's not that I want to contextualize this question, but I do want to think about being sons and daughters of the South. Will our side of the families be looked differently in Vietnam's future one day? And I think that's a burning question that I always have inside of me.
Ken, I have an answer for you already. I personally know young Vietnamese people, 20 years old, living in Vietnam, born and raised in Vietnam, who are looking upon the South in much more complex ways. I'll say
thank you for that. Thank you for entertaining this question. I mean, that's like, yeah, that's going to be like the carrot that we're dangling here in this episode. Let's go.
Okay. So as the professor, what I'm going to do in today's class is I'm going to first briefly review, because it's important, I'm going to review some things that we discussed in the last episode because it's directly relevant to what we're going to talk about today. The time period we're concerned with are the 1920s. So we discussed that in our episode on Nguyen An Ninh. Now, as the listener might remember, the 1920s was a period that we might describe as radicalism, that there was a surging mood of radicalism. And by that, what me and Huy Tam Ho Tai, these scholars, mean is this period of iconoclasm. So young Vietnamese are rejecting cherished beliefs. They feel suffocated by Vietnamese tradition and all forms of authority, of the French colonial regime, of Vietnamese parents, of Confucianism, of the monarchy. These young people just want to break free as individuals. They want to recreate themselves anew. So Nguyen An Ninh is this figure that leads this mood in the 1920s. And Ninh says that the Vietnamese must learn from the West and from the East, and they need to think for themselves. They need to become writers, artists, poets. Okay? Now, as I mentioned, scholars call this period radicalism. And I don't want to be too misleading here, because there is, of course, another radical school of thought that will come in the in the 1930s and really take hold in the 1930s, which is, of course, Marxism-Leninism. That's also very radical. But this iconoclasm, before Marxism comes to Vietnam, this is what I mean, and that's led by Ho Chi Minh. So, okay, 1920s, Vietnamese thinkers are debating, what should we do with tradition? Really, what do we do? New ideas are coming in from the West. France has been colonizing Vietnam for several decades by now. The young Vietnamese are being trained in the French language and French language schools. They're being exposed to ideas from the West. What should the Vietnamese do with tradition? So against Nguyen An Ninh and against this radicalism is Phạm Quyền. So in many ways, Phạm Quyền is a conservative. Ken, what comes to mind immediately when you hear the word conservative?
I want to go back into the way I've always done things. I want to go back into tradition. I want to drill down on Confucian ideology. I don't want to grow. I don't want to expand into new thinking frontier. I want to conserve what we have. I want to build upon what we have.
This is Kevin Pham. Thank you so much for listening. For these episodes, I do research for them and write them at a cafe. If you'd like to buy me a coffee so that I can do more of these, or just to show your appreciation, you can go to the YouTube episode and buy a Super Thanks, which directly supports this series, Viet History Makers.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's largely right. One thing, though, that is key to this word conservatism, and by conservatism, I really don't mean the kind of, I think in the U.S., when we hear the word conservatism, we might think of, oh, I have mine, so no changes. Like, I've got mine, so no changes.
Right.
What I mean by conservatism here, and in political theory, there's a longer history and a philosophy of conservatism. This is the grandfather of philosophical conservatism is Edmund Burke. And he was famous for criticizing the French Revolution. And his conservatism, simply put, just meant he's very skeptical of fast change. He's skeptical of fast change and of deep change. So he thinks that if you try to change things too fast, it'll be a disaster. Because there's wisdom in tradition. There's wisdom in the institutions that your ancestors have created. And if you try to destroy it, what comes next might be really bad. So Edmund Burke is going to say, look at the French Revolution. It ended up being a disaster. You had the French Terror, where innocent people were being executed. So this kind of conservatism sees generations as being linked to each other, and that if you try to cut it because you think you're being so rational, well, you're actually being very arrogant, because the generations are your time is much more wise than you, and the things that have endured is much more wise than you as an individual. So don't try to break something so quickly.
Right.
Anyway, I wanted to briefly touch on that word conservatism here, and we're going to get more into that. So, okay, remember Nguyen An Ninh, he said that the Vietnamese elites hang on to Confucianism pathetically, like shipwrecked people hang on to a raft. Instead, the Vietnamese should just let go and swim for themselves. That's Nguyen An Ninh. But Pham Quyen is essentially going to respond and say, you're wrong, Ninh. The Vietnamese need their Confucian raft. If they let go, they'll drown. So I'm going to quote Pham Quyen here. He says, Vietnamese youth, exclusively formed in the French schools and completely detached from the old ancestral disciplines, are despondent. So they're discouraged, they're lazy, and they're confused. They've been uprooted from their tradition. They're thrown into these French schools. And Pham Quyen is going to say, Ninh is dangerous. He's uprooted. He's an example of why the Vietnamese should move slowly and carefully. So there's a really amusing moment where Pham Quyen writes this article about Nguyen An Ninh, and he says, folks, Nguyen Thanh Ninh himself admitted that since he was 18 years old, he has had a spiritual crisis. Nguyen Thanh Ninh doubts his ideas. He even considered becoming a Buddhist monk. Like, he should have become a monk and practice at it rather than write incendiary articles. Even the Buddha meditated a long time before preaching. So Pham Quyên is going to attack Nguyen Thanh Ninh. Now, Nguyen Thanh Ninh, as I had mentioned in the last episode, was famous for being a young iconoclast. But actually, Pham Quyên is more of a significant intellectual at the time, 1920s. So Nguyen Thanh Ninh was famous for his speeches and his articles urging the Vietnamese to break free. So Nguyen Thanh Ninh had a journal called La Cloche Fêlée, but Pham Quyên had his own journal called Nam Phong. By the way, Nam Phong is also the name of the podcast that I co-host with Yin Vu. And shout out to my friend Yin Vu. She published an article on Pham Quyên, so listeners might want to check out her essay. It's called Pham Quyên, Borrowed Language and the Ambivalences of Colonial Discourse. So in that essay, she shows how Pham Quyên's use of the French language actually challenges French colonialism. So anyway, the point here is that Pham Quyên wrote a lot more than Nguyen Thanh Ninh. Pham Quyên is older than Ninh. Ninh was born in 1900. Pham Quyên was born in 1892. So 8 years older.
Can I ask you something? What's your family's story worth to you? And I'm not talking about the shiny ones that everybody knows about. I mean the buried ones, the secrets, the heartbreaks, the ones that only slipped out after a night of too much Hennessy. That's what Vietnam Story Bank is for. No polish, no rewrites, no editing, just raw, recorded, beautiful beating history. The kind that makes you sit up and hold your breath. Your father's memories of his mother's wildest dreams. Your grandparents' laughter that echoes in your bones. We dig it all up. We record it and hand it back to you. Safe, untouchable, and unforgettable. Because when your stories disappear, they're gone forever. So go to VietnamStoryBank.com today and make sure your family's stories are recorded.
And can you give me a little context where the French were during this time in relation to Pham Quyên's development?
Yeah, definitely. We're going to get there. So that's going to be in the bio that I want to go through. But before I get there, I do want to start off with a personal story of why I'm interested in Pham Quyên. So it's the spring of 2018. And my wife and I were in Vietnam. We're on vacation. It's the first time I'm taking her to Vietnam. And we're in Hanoi. And we randomly walk into a bookstore. And I wasn't looking for anything in particular. But a bright, orange, beautiful-looking cover of a book, a thick book, caught my eye. And when I saw that the author was Pham Quyên, I was so confused. I was genuinely puzzled and shocked. Why? Because I'm a student of Vietnamese history. I knew from my reading that Pham Quyên was seen as a terrible traitor to the Vietnamese communists. And he was a collaborator with the French. He was always saying nice things about the French. He even would justify French violence. So he seemed very pro-colonial. But here, there's a book of his writings in Vietnamese, published in Hanoi. So what's going on here? Is the Vietnamese government today now publishing the writings of traitors? So in 1945, the Viet Minh executed him. He was like among the first to be executed. Pham Quyên has been described as an arch collaborator, as obsequious, servile, a French lackey, you know, just a servant. And so what is going on here? Well, I open up the book and I start reading, and here's what I read. So I'm gonna quote from the book that I was holding. The intro of the book says this. It says, quote, Pham Quyên is a pioneer. He has made important contributions through using the national language script and promoting the construction of a national education system. He also actively translated and spread the essence of Eastern and Western ideas with the aim of enlightening the Vietnamese people and fostering the nation's traditions and national soul.
Okay, before you go on, I think we need to break down this idea of quốc ngữ, I believe, because this is something that is why I think they would publish a book like from a traitor, quote unquote, because this is arguably not the father of quốc ngữ, but this is an ardent early supporter of the transition between, I think, Chữ Hán, which is the Chinese form of Vietnamese, into the Romanic, the Roman alphabet of our language.
Yes. You know, I do want to tease the listener here because I have a whole section in our discussion today devoted to quốc ngữ. So the listener and you, Ken, will have to wait.
I'm chomping at the bit here because he's a pivotal figure in our country's history.
Yes. The editor's introduction of the book, let me continue. The editor says, the essays demonstrate an amazing writing and thinking ability, a serious spirit, hard work, and trusting heart. It's been 100 years since the inception of Nam Phong, but the scholar's contributions to the development of modern Vietnamese culture are still a milestone of special significance today. So now it's beginning to make sense to me. Here's what's happening. Yes, Tham Quynh was seen as a traitor, but today the Vietnamese government is using him and recasting him as a hero, as someone who saved Vietnamese culture at a time when the French were trying to erase Vietnamese culture. Even the Communist Party, so Mac Thi, who is a Communist Party member, and I found this out, he argued, quote, it's necessary to clearly see the malicious plot of the French colonialists to make young Vietnamese people, students, and intellectuals forget their mother tongue, worship the French language, worship French culture, and despise Vietnamese cultural heritage. At that time, all high schools used French in all lectures, and Vietnamese was only used for about 2 hours a week. Nam Phong contributed to awakening a sense of respect for the Vietnamese language and Vietnamese cultural heritage in society. So there you go. A Communist Party member is praising Tham Quynh for saving Vietnamese culture.
Okay, so wait, let's go back a little bit. Because you brought up the fact that the Viet Minh killed him. Why did they kill him? I mean, I know that's way down in the bio. But now I'm like, okay, he sounds like a hero, but why did the Viet Minh put him to death? I mean, you don't have to answer that now, but that's going on in my mind.
This is great. I'm going to answer exactly that question. One more thing. According to a story published in 2017, this is quite recent, Ho Chi Minh's secretary, Vu Dinh Huynh, reported that when Ho Chi Minh was informed that Tham Quynh had been killed, this is 1945. Apparently, this is a story he tells, Ho Chi Minh became silent, stretched his arms across a table, and said, I have met and interacted with Mr. Pham in France. He is not a bad person. Look at this. We see this revival of this figure, Tham Quynh. We see a totally new reading of Tham Quynh. Okay, now let me go into the bio here, okay? This is going to be a bit longer, so feel free to stop me here. But let me go through Tham Quynh's life. So Tham Quynh was born in Hải Dương in North Vietnam in 1892. His father, like many fathers, was a Confucian scholar. And Tham Quynh's parents actually died when he was young. So he was raised by his paternal grandmother in Hanoi. And in Hanoi, he attended a school for interpreters. So he's training to be a translator, basically. He graduates in 1908 when he was 16, and then he works as a translator at the École Française d'Extrême-Orient, so a French school. He was very talented as an interpreter, and this is important because the Sûreté, the French secret police, the colonial police, they now have an eye on him. He's a good boy, right? He's a hardworking student. He's a good interpreter. So he seems to the French like a good candidate for the French colonial regime's class of loyal indigenous collaborators under the leadership of Albert Sorot, who is the French governor general at the time. Now, let's step back for a brief moment. If you're France and your goal is to colonize a country and you want their resources, you want their labor, what are you going to do? You can't dominate and control the whole country yourself. You need collaborators. You need to get the indigenous elite to do the dirty work for you, right? So, Ken, let me ask you, if you're France, if you're a colonizer, how do you get the natives to work for you? What do you do?
I think first off, you need to convert them into your language. You need to make sure that as many people as possible speak the language of the oppressor.
Okay, so that's one thing. What else?
Perhaps religion. Religion is something that seems to be part of that systemic program. They bring in missionaries to convert you into believing in their God.
Right, but again, okay, you're the colonizer and you want to get the natives to essentially oppress their own people for you. What else are you going to do, though?
I think you pay them a lot of money.
Yes. You give them promotions. You give them status. You give them money.
Right.
And so the French are going to turn to the Confucian elite, and they're going to want to get them to work for the French. So soon after leaving the school for interpreters, Fan Kun becomes the assistant editor for Dongzhong Tapchi, the Indochina Review. And this is led by another French selected editor, Nguyen Van Vinh, who's another very interesting figure. So Nguyen Van Vinh was known for his attacks on the Vietnamese educated class because he said they failed to study the French language and they failed to appreciate French ideas. So the French love this Nguyen Van Vinh guy. So according to Nguyen Van Vinh, the Vietnamese were hurting themselves by learning about the West through Chinese translations of Western ideas and texts. So he wants them to learn French. Now, what happens is Pham Quyen agrees with Nguyen Van Vinh. So Pham Quyen and Nguyen Van Vinh, they are part of this Francophone elite. Their French is really good. And they're going to argue that the Vietnamese need, that the masses of Vietnamese people, they're not ready actually to learn about Western ideas on their own. What the masses of Vietnamese people need are elites like them to sift through Western ideas and provide interpretations of those ideas that would benefit the Vietnamese so that they cannot allow the Vietnamese to be exposed to harmful ideas. So they're really elite here. And they think that that's what the Vietnamese need. And Pham Quyen is going to say, this is what Japan did. And that's how Japan became so modern, because their elite said, okay, we're going to read all these Western ideas and we're going to choose for you, the normal Vietnamese people, we're going to tell you what ideas are good, what ideas are bad, or we're going to not talk about the bad ideas. Okay, so the French officials, the government, they bring in Albert Sorot, who is a French governor general. And this is really important because Sorot was a progressive. He's kind of a, to put a lack of a better term, like one of these humanistic colonizers, like a friendly colonizer, let's put it that way. So basically, revolts in Vietnam had been breaking out in 1908. There are riots. There are plots to poison and assassin French officials. And back in France, they're telling each other, like, all right, you guys, this is looking pretty nasty. The Vietnamese are rebelling. If we want to hang on to our colony, we need to bring in a different French governor general and create some reforms to make the Vietnamese happier, basically, so that they won't revolt on us and get all rebellious. So they send in Albert Sorot, who's a socialist, he's a progressive, and he's governor general from 1912 to 1914, and then from 1917 to 1919. And he does it, so he argues for a more enlightened, more liberal, more humane colonialism. He says, France must benefit its colonies. We must stop being racist. He promises to increase native representation in local assemblies. He promises to do educational reforms. He promises to give more freedom of expression for the elites, by the way, for the elite Vietnamese. And so therefore, he basically tells his regime approach Pham Quynh, and they say, hey, we want you to create a new journal, and we want you to spread ideas about the West. And so Pham Quynh accepts this, and he creates Nam Phong, Nam Phong Dap Chi. Now, what actually happens with Saro's promises? They don't get passed. Any guesses why? He made all these promises, let's increase native representation in politics, but they don't pass. Any guesses, Ken? Why don't they pass?
Yeah, but let me ask you before I guess, is this not passing within the French colonial government system, or is it, I mean, there's no democracy, there's nobody voting in terms of passing. This is back in France not passing, right?
Well, French settlers in Vietnam are going to resist Albert Sarraut's promises because they don't want to get kicked out legally from Vietnam. Right? So it's the French settlers who are going to oppose this French governor general. So Pham Quynh, he says, okay, I'll start this journal, Nam Phong. The first issue was published in July of 1917. The journal was explicitly supposed to be propaganda for the colonial state. However, and this is where it gets interesting, Pham Quynh, as editor, was given a degree of freedom from censorship that was special for its time. Because Pham Quynh would always say really nice things about the French. And in turn, the French just, they trusted him. Therefore, Pham Quynh was allowed to say whatever he wanted. And I'm going to suggest that Pham Quynh then does something pretty subversive here. He's going to use his privileges, but he's going to use his journal to promote what I would consider to be cultural resistance. So he's actually going to really promote Vietnamese culture, and he's going to actually resist many Western ideas. And I think it's a very clever thing to do because he's a collaborator, but he's going to use his freedom, right, to do what he thinks is the best thing that he could do for Vietnam at this time.
And is he doing this publicly in French, or is he doing this quietly in Vietnamese?
Amazing question. One really remarkable thing about Nam Phong, the journal, is it was trilingual. Mm. There were essays in French translated into Vietnamese and Chinese. So you had French, Vietnamese, and Chinese. So it's a public journal here. And it was one of the most widely read and most influential journals of its day.
Can we get copies of that journal online? How do we access?
Yes, you can. Yes, you can. So there you can actually, it's all been digitized actually. And maybe I'll put up the link in the YouTube description later.
Can you tell me a little bit about it? Like how long were they? How many editions were there?
So many issues. I mean, these are hundreds and hundreds of pages. Like Pham Quynh, the book that I had mentioned at the beginning of this episode, that was a thick volume, but it was only just a few of his essays. Now, his political essays were mostly written in French. So, but there are articles in Vietnamese. And so I'll talk more about Nam Phong in a little bit here. But many young intellectuals at the time would use Nam Phong, the journal, as a kind of textbook, basically, in order to learn about Eastern and Western ideas. So Pham Quynh is really, really the first, I would say, to seriously introduce Vietnamese people to Western thought, okay? Now, I'm supposed to be doing the bio here, but I keep getting hung up. There's so many interesting things here, so let me just finish the bio. Pham Quynh was also politically active. So in 1926, he attempts to create a political party called Vietnam Dân Bộ Dân Hội, Vietnamese People's Progressive League. And this is aimed at gaining Vietnamese support for reforms and also to stop the radicalism of Nguyen An Ninh. So he wanted this party to collaborate closely with the colonial regime in order to raise the intellectual, moral, and economic standards of the country. So this party actually attracted a lot of people, such as Phan Boi Châu. Phan Boi Châu was attracted to this party. And for exactly that reason, another governor general at the time refused to approve it. So here, I'm starting to paint a picture of Pham Quyen as much more of a subversive figure than we might think. So Pham Quyen also becomes involved with this association called the Association for Intellectual and Moral Formation of the Annamites. Hội Khai Trí Tiến Đức. So it's a state-sponsored organization aimed at uniting Confucian and French-trained elites. Okay, 1932, Pham Quyen is appointed the secretary of Emperor Bao Dai. So remember in our episode on Bao Dai becomes emperor. And so he's creating a new cabinet in Hue. Pham Quyen works for the cabinet. So the French is going to reject calls for reforms. They want to have reforms to give more power to Bao Dai's government. But the French don't let Bao Dai have real power here. And so in that moment, some members of the cabinet resign. However, Pham Quyen stays on, and he's going to act as the Minister of Education and Minister of the Interior until 1945. Now we are coming to his final days. So that year, of course, it's the August Revolution. Viet Minh revolutionaries seize power. And shortly after, they arrest Pham Quyen at his home in Hue. They take him to a forest and they execute him along with Ngô Đình Khôi and Ngô Đình Huân, a brother and a nephew of Ngô Đình Diệm, right? And so the men, those men, are buried in unmarked graves, and that's their end. It's a very sad, tragic ending there for them.
So the Ngô Đình nephew and brother,
yeah,
their bodies are nowhere to be found.
I'm not sure about that.
But Pham Quyen was executed with those two?
Yes.
At the same time?
Yes.
But did they recover Pham Quyen? They probably did recover Pham Quyen's body.
These are great questions. I should know this. I don't know if they've recovered his body.
Yeah, I mean, we can move on. These are just small. You know, the relationship that we have, I just want everybody to know that these are not planned between you and I. I'm chomping at the bit constantly, and I'm trying to, you know, jump ahead all the time. So I want everybody to know these are not things that Kevin and I plan. We're literally going through timeline, but, you know, I have these questions, these random thoughts in my brain that I'm like, should I ask now? And these are just, you know, not as important, but I am wondering, you know, is his body buried somewhere in Hanoi? You know,
that's what I always come to think of it. I think I probably just assumed that they were just killed and left somewhere in the forest and that we don't know where their bodies are. I could be completely wrong. They might actually be recovered and buried somewhere. That's
so
a good question.
What happens after he gets executed?
So after he gets executed, we have the First Indochina War, the Second Indochina War. But what's going on in Hanoi is that he's completely ignored. Even you have anthologies of literature about Vietnamese literature, and they just completely ignore him because he's seen as a traitor to the revolution here. And that's why I wanted to make the point of, oh, today Vietnam is publishing his work. Now I want to get to the point where I want to talk about Pham Quyen's ideas, okay? So was he a collaborator? Was he a hero? What is he? He's kind of a puzzle. So one thing I want to talk about is that he thinks that the Vietnamese people are confronted with a major obstacle. And I'm talking about the 1920s when he's writing here. He's going to argue that the Vietnamese youth are experiencing a debilitating moral malaise. And that means a kind of restlessness, uneasiness, depression, basically. And this depression among the youth is caused by a sudden influx of Western ideas. Western ideas are coming in, and the youth basically don't think that Vietnam has anything to offer. They think Vietnamese culture is inferior, and Vietnamese values are, to put a lack of a better term, bad, dumb, boring, worthless, right? And he thinks that's really terrible that the Vietnamese think that. He thinks that the Vietnamese are experiencing a kind of internalized inferiority, that maybe their culture isn't so great. His solution is to assert Vietnamese culture and to say, actually, Vietnamese culture is brilliant, genius. It's just as good as the West, actually. And he wants to balance and harmonize Western and Eastern ideas. And the way he wants to do this is he wants to renew attention in Vietnam to Confucianism and to Vietnamese national literature and to developing the Vietnamese language. So let's talk about this, okay? French education in Western ideals. Now, to him, the Western ideal was power. He thinks that the West is just obsessed with power, obsessed with science and technology. The West wants to control and dominate nature. But all that has done is produce disaster. Look at World War I. Look at all the weapons that these Westerners have created, just killing so many people. And this is a horrible thing for the world if we allow Western power and science. Like, the West doesn't care about anything important. They just want to dominate the world with their science, he thinks. So I'm going to quote him. He says, "Obliged to bow down to Western power, Eastern wisdom has fallen back. Eastern wisdom has wondered anxiously which way to turn. Sometimes suspicious of herself, she was hesitant and puzzled." So he's saying that the Vietnamese have lost their confidence. The Vietnamese are actually very wise people. And that's what the West needs. They need Vietnamese wisdom. Vietnamese wisdom will be a good thing for the world, he thinks. He says, "Every step taken in the acquisition of modern Western science marks for man a setback in the field of moral and spiritual values." It's a pretty big statement. What do you think of that, Ked? Do you agree with that?
You know, I think about my mom and dad. When you talk like this, because I think that my father and a lot of fathers that I knew didn't think that there was any quote-unquote wisdom or modern sort of things that we could get from the Confucian or the old ways. I feel like that. I asked my mom last night, "Do you know who Pham Quynh is? Can you tell me about him?" She said, "I have no idea who that is." And I suspect most people don't know who Pham Quynh is of that generation. Don't know. So when I think about what you just said about how he thinks, I don't know if I entirely agree with it, because it's you know, I think that, well, where are we getting these old ideas and the Vietnamese Confucius? Where is it? There's no context for any of us. I think modern Vietnamese living, we don't know what that actually means to actually go up against French ideals or Western ideals. How do you compare it if you don't know?
And this is a good moment for me to suggest to every listener here, especially if you're Vietnamese, to start learning up on your Confucianism. Confucianism is a fascinating school of thought, Chinese school of thought.
Some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a huge inheritance. But a phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard for a new one on us. Just trade in any phone from our top brands with select unlimited plans. $829.99 purchase with new smartphone line on select unlimited plans. Minimum $90 per month with auto pay plus taxes and fees for 36 months required. Plus $830 trade-in slash promo credit applied over 36 months. Trade-in terms apply. Payoff phone requires smartphone purchase and port-in with new smartphone line on select plan. Must provide most recent bill showing payoff amount of eligible phone. Additional terms apply.
But it's certainly not the only one. You also have Moism, you have legalism, you have these different competing schools of Chinese thought. The 100 schools of thought, especially during the Warring States period in China. But it's fascinating. Chinese philosophy is fascinating. And if you want to study Vietnamese history and ideas, you simply cannot avoid learning about Chinese philosophy. So there's
a few good, I'm going to do a shameless plug here for my upcoming project that I've been thinking about for a long time. I used to ask all the time, what does it mean to be Vietnamese in the podcast? But I had recurring guests. I had people who are, you know, coming back and, you know, like I wouldn't do it in Vid History Makers, you know, because it'd be redundant. Now, I keep thinking about this question, what does it mean to be Vietnamese? And as I'm listening to you talk about Pham Quynh, and I'm listening to you say Confucianism, and I think about Chinese culture, and I think, what does it really mean to be Vietnamese? And it, from where I sit now, after years of doing this, a lot of this comes to me in the form of proverbs. It comes in the form of these four syllables, six syllables, eight syllables that are put together sometimes as a short poem, or sometimes as just a string of words that gives you powerful lessons. And I'm going to focus this year, I'm going to put it out there, 2025 is to give as many of those as I possibly can and speak in Vietnamese, giving the explanation in English. That's because awesome. That is a way for me to learn. And these are things that we hear our grandmothers, our grandfathers, our mom and dad. You know, every time you turn left, turn right, they're going to bust out one of these proverbs and they're going to give you a lesson with the short, you know, a quick four syllable, you know, four words. And I think what Pham Quynh is returning to is the wisdom of these proverbs. And I want to really bring this to light this year, because I think that that is the essence of being Vietnamese. It really is the essence of being Vietnamese.
I love that. That's an awesome, I look forward to that. That's great. And what I'm going to guess here that most of those proverbs are going to be very heavily influenced by Confucianism.
Yes.
And so, okay, let me quote Pham Quynh one more time here. He says, "The misdeeds of science without conscience have never appeared so clearly to Orientals as during the immense massacre of which the whole of the West has just been theater." He's talking about World War I. "If all Western power with its murderous science only ends in this vast collective madness, how can Orientals avoid feeling sorrow for the loss of their ancient wisdom?" Well, like, he does not sound like a kowtowing, you know, excuse my language, butt kisser of the West here. He is like really criticizing the West. And he's going to say the East is actually wise. And so he's going to go on to tell his readers to be very careful about adopting Western values. He's going to criticize the individualism of the West. He says, individualism could be good. He says, it can give a positive character to old traditional ideas that tend to discount individuals a bit too much by inscribing them completely within the family or the community, and in this way hinder the full development of their personality. But if you act alone without the solid base of good traditional training, these theories of individualism may cause disillusion and destruction. The delicate matter of the dosage must be respected, as it requires much foresight and tact and can be the work only of an elite truly conscious of its role as an initiator and guide. So he's really elitist here. He's basically going to say that only educated elites like him can control the right dosage of individualism from the West, the dosage of bad Western ideas. So he wants the Vietnamese to be very careful about the ideas that they adopt from the West.
Wow. I think when I initially was researching Femquin, I think I got it all wrong. It's crazy. You know, we go into these episodes. Just, I thought he was more along the lines of somebody who was, because the in the research that I wrote or read was really all about him being an ardent supporter of you know, French thought and but it's not what you think it is.
Dude, this is why I think it's so fascinating. When you actually read closely, you're like, wait a second, this doesn't match up with the standard narratives of Femquin.
Yeah,
people just like repeat things and they don't like look deep into what the person actually said, you know?
Yeah, he's like a big Trojan horse.
It's like, that's a great, I didn't use that term, but I would call him that. Yes, that's a great.
He's a huge Trojan horse. Yeah.
So let me now turn to his, why he thinks Confucius is so important. So he has these essays saying why Confucius is so valuable and important for the Vietnamese. And he says, Confucius aims, quote, to maintain social order and human peace based on the practice of humanity, justice, respect, and propriety. And he's just going to go on to say, yes, it might seem outdated, but there is a way to modernize it and to make it harmonize with the West here. For example, he uses the word justice when he's talking about Confucianism. That's very weird if you know something about Confucianism, because Confucianism doesn't say anything about justice. It's not a value. It's not a value in Confucianism. You know what is a value? Harmony. It's kind of like, imagine in an ideal family, you don't really talk about justice in an ideal family. You think of harmony, of like balancing differences, of everybody having their own role. At the dinner table, you know, you don't talk about justice. You only talk about justice when something bad happens, and then you have to talk about justice.
Okay, we're going to get, I need to get into this then. This idea of harmony, it only works top down. Harmony in Asian cultures, and I don't want to just say it very generally. When you think of harmony, the only way you're going to get harmony is this cycle of like top down. And when you think of justice, you think that when your parents or grandparents say something wrong or do something wrong, that you have the ability to speak up and fight back and correct their way of thinking. And I think that that is very indicative of the governments, the people inside governments in the West and the East. It's a very general sort of skeletal structure for me, but therein lies the inherent differences that we're talking about, that we've been talking about for weeks.
I hear you. Let me now gently push back a little bit. I think you're correct in describing what actually happens in real life when people talk about harmony. However, for Femquin and many Confucians, the ideal, not how it is in real life, but the ideal, the goal of harmony, here is what harmony should look like. Harmony should be not top down. It should be where you have diverse elements mutually enhancing each other. So for example, think of a delicious soup, Thai soup, for example. It has different flavors, spicy, salty, sweet, sour. They all come together, they enhance each other. Think of an orchestra. You have different diverse instruments that make different sounds, but when they harmonize together, it's a beautiful thing because everything works in concert. Each thing enhances the other. Now, there's no top-down there, but there is diversity of roles. So, for example, in an ideal family, you have the father and you have the son. Yes, you might see that as a hierarchy. However, you might also see it as the father has very specific duties to the son, and the son has specific duties to the father. And those duties are different, but they all harmonize together. So it's the ideal is not supposed to be top down. But I think you're describing like what often actually happens.
Yeah. This is great. This is a great thing to point out. I think the actual philosophical side of it is harmony in that way. And when you're telling me this, it brings a really important story to my mind. I remember when my brother had been living in, he's been in Vietnam for 21 years now. And I remember my attitude towards my brother shifting in terms of like, we are not equals. In America, we were equals and we'd get in a fight. And when he got to Vietnam after a few years, he said to me, you know, there's a beautiful system at play here. He said, I was cold. I was sitting downstairs and I was cold. And he has all these employees that were former students at RMIT. He said, I was cold. And three kids leapt to their feet and said, teacher, I will go and get a jacket for you. He said, in that way, it forced me to become a better leader because of the love that went the other way. It just forces you. And that totally changed the way I looked at this. The theoretical side being played into the practical side of Confucian story. And as you're telling me these, you know, the principles here, I think about that. There, I always go back to my brother's story about that.
That's a brilliant example, because what it shows to me is it's an example of the Confucian idea that society should be thought of as a big family. That's very different from the Western liberal tradition, where society is not seen like a family, but it's seen as a contract. For the West, society is a contract between individuals who have rights, who consent to a contract. But in Vietnam, I like to use this, like when I went to Vietnam, and this is quite common when you go nhậu at a quán nhậu, you will drink beer, and then the waiters will come up to you. They'll shake your can to see if it's empty, and if it's slightly empty, they're just going to give you a new one. They won't ask you for your consent. They're going to give you the beer. That's something like a family. You know, they figure out what your needs are. They're going to do. But in the West, you know, it's like, would you like to have? You know, there's this language of contract. You know, but it's different in Confucian societies where it's a family, where you just have duties towards each other.
But there's a different type of contract, because that changed the dynamic of my brother and I. It really did. After that, the arguments and the fighting, whenever I go back to Vietnam, became less and less and less and less. I started to not argue with my brother, because I could watch him conceding to many unspoken things that I wanted. Jiu means to give in. Jiu means to kind of to give your kid or your younger brother the thing that he wants, to give him a little favor. I watched that sort of that tug of war start to happen emotionally between us. And I was like, oh, this is a different system. This is actually a very harmonious system where we didn't have to, it was unspoken. It was and between my brother and I, it's a beautiful sort of dance now where if I don't agree with him, I don't need to say it. I don't need to say it. I don't need to point it out. And it just kind of, whenever I need something, he can kind of read it ahead of time. So there's a beauty there. But yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, this is one point that I wanted to make, is that a lot of Vietnamese people, a lot of Vietnamese Americans, such as myself, I didn't grow up reading Confucius. I didn't grow up studying Confucianism. But later in life, once I actually did, once I started learning about Confucianism, I started realizing how much of my habits, my values, the way I treat others has been informed by Confucianism. And it kind of reminds me of how in the West, in North America, in Europe, even people who call themselves atheists, they're actually deep down informed by Christian values, whether they like it or not, whether they know it or not. My professor in grad school had a great story where he told us that he had a friend who was a proud atheist. The friend used to be a Catholic, but one time they went skiing, and then my professor gave his friend a granola bar. Anyway, later in the day, they're on the ski lift together. My professor takes out his granola bar and starts eating it. And then he goes, oh, to his friend, did you eat your granola bar already? And the friend says, oh, I lost it. And then my professor says, oh, well, let me give you another one. And the guy goes, oh, no, it's okay. I lost it. I deserve to not get another one. And my professor goes, aha, Catholic guilt. Like, it's deeply ingrained in you. Even if you think you're an atheist, you are really raised by these values, you know. And in San Jose, you know, we would go to Gom. You know, we would do, prostrating before our ancestors, enacting out these Confucian rituals. Nobody explained to me what they were, but this is deeply Confucian.
Yeah, we live in these moral frameworks.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that they guide, these moral frameworks guide your thinking whether you like it or not. And I think that's the struggle between being Vietnamese American and, you know, dealing with your mom and dad sometimes, because we are trying to kind of figure out that system or this system. And nobody's really pointed out, you know, my mom used to always say, that's how we do it in the North. You know, I don't have to tell my brother. I'm like, well, I come from a very different system. Now I'm beginning to understand it, you know, as a grown man, but I didn't understand it. And I would rebel against the way that they conducted their familial ties, their relationships. It was just intolerable for me. And, you know, I had no tolerance for it.
Yeah. I think it helps also to read and study these value systems in a bit of a formal way, because then once you have words and you're like, oh, that's where it comes from, then you can kind of reflect on it from a distance.
There's hundreds of these things that are happening, hundreds of these touch points that are happening for people who are displaced from their original homeland, who have second, third generation kids outside of their, and that is where, you know, today you look at the prison population and the Vietnamese who were committing crimes 25, 30, 40 years ago, this is a result of like cultures clashing and, you know, the young kids not understanding where their sort of place in their mom and dad's or uncle's families were.
And this is what Thap Nguyen would say, the cause of the youth's confusion is them forgetting the basis of their moral values. It's them forgetting the foundation of it all, which is Confucianism. And Confucianism is not this boring, static thing Thap Nguyen is going to say. It's actually a very complex, dynamic tradition. Anyway, so I think we've talked a lot about Confucian. What I want to do now is I want to turn to Quốc ngữ, because
he was just going to ask you that. Can we go back to Quốc ngữ?
Yeah. So, in the Nam Phong Journal, Thap Nguyen is not just rebelling against Western domination of ideas and promoting Confucianism. He's also promoting Quốc ngữ. So he's going to say, quote, I have devoted all my fervor and love to my mother tongue. I swore a long time ago to sacrifice my whole life to this task, to build a literature with our language so as to give to our country an independent national literature, and to see to it that our people would no longer have to suffer the pain of learning and imitating everything from foreigners. There you go. He sounds like a proud nationalist, right?
He's going to say, yeah.
Yeah. So, okay, Quốc ngữ, how did it develop? Who developed it and why, and what was Thap Nguyen's role? So let's step back here for a little bit. For centuries, the Vietnamese people had been speaking Chinese and Vietnamese and writing in classical Chinese and chữ nôm. So chữ nôm, of course, is Chinese characters that express Vietnamese words. But Portuguese missionaries in the 16th century, they introduced Quốc ngữ, which is, I mean, it literally means national Quốc ngữ language, but what it is Romanized alphabetic Vietnamese script. So the script is further developed, most famously, in the 17th century by the French Jesuit Alexandre de Rode, and he produces a Vietnamese-Portuguese-Latin dictionary. It's printed in Rome in 1651 using that spelling system. Now, that writing system essentially goes dormant, goes quiet, until French colonizers come in the 1850s, 1860s. Now, In an earlier episode, I think it was the one on Fanboy Cho, we talked about the Tonkin Free School, the Dongkin Yetok. That was 1907. And if you read the text in those school, that school, they're really going to promote Gukno. And they're going to say, look, if we want our country to develop, we need to develop this language in Romanized script. It's central.
Let's talk about the literacy rate before this happens. Very low, right?
Very low. And so their aim was to make people as literate as possible. And they argued that it's a lot easier to learn Latin script than Chinese characters. So, and also not just that, it was cheaper to print than Chinese characters. That's a big deal. Cheaper to print.
I never thought of that. Wow. Let's just really break that mechanical side down. In typesetting printing, when you typeset back in the day, you just swap out 26 or whatever, 24 alphabet letters. In the Chinese characters, it's almost infinite amount of characters. So in order to print in Chinese, it's a very Herculean task. Absolutely. As opposed to Romance.
Yeah, and you appreciate this one. Well, I did when I was in Lyon in December, and I went to this museum just about printing, the history of printing. Oh my God, like the time it took to manually move the typesetting here.
This is what I learned. I was in high school. I was a printer for 3 years, and I went to a technical high school. So instantly when you said that, I go, oh, that makes perfect sense. Never thought about that. So that's why we didn't have a whole lot of books or intellectual thought that was moving around in those days. Oh my God, it makes perfect sense. It's economics.
Yeah, yeah. So the Dongkin Yetok, 1907, they're saying, let's promote Gukngyo. It's not just them. You have a lot of other Vietnamese nationalists. Phan Chu Trinh, he's going to argue, and I'm going to quote him, Vietnam cannot be saved without getting rid of Chinese characters. That's what he says here. And Pham Quyen is going to more explicitly say we need to develop Gukngyo. And he says, and I'm going to quote him again, he says, the Vietnamese should not, so he says, today our country must study Gukngyo and French letters, but neither must Chinese writing be abandoned. So he has a high bar for the Vietnamese. He wants them to learn Vietnamese, French, and Chinese. And also so many words in Vietnamese come from Chinese. So he's, it's really fascinating when you look at Nam Phong in the back of the issue, he actually has a whole vocabulary building project where he says, our Vietnamese language does not have enough words to express all the things that need to be expressed. And so I'm going to start building this vocabulary. And he starts like introducing terms to the Vietnamese and creates a vocabulary. So I just want to say a bit more about Gukngyo here. So now when I was in Paris in the archives, and arguably there's this very famous essay, it's not by Pham Quyen, but it's by this lawyer named Phan Van Trung. And he delivers a speech in 1925 titled Educational Efforts Among the Annamite People. And that whole essay is basically, here's why we need to promote Gukngyo. So he says, all education, language, and writing systems, it's all interdependent. If the Vietnamese could do it all properly, it could strengthen itself to be free from French colonial rule. And so he really promotes Gukngyo there. But one other thing about Gukngyo for Pham Quyen is that he believed it contained Vietnam's national soul. So he believed in a nation's soul. And the soul of a nation is really through its language. And so I had mentioned the vocabulary building project. He says, our national language at present is poor. We don't have enough words to express important ideas. So he goes on to present new Vietnamese words based on Chinese and French. So despotism, skepticism, epic, and so on. And so he's going to import foreign concepts from French and Chinese, which he thinks will enrich the Vietnamese language. So there you go. In real time, he's creating Gukngyo here. Like, that's pretty big.
Okay. We we have to stop this. I am getting this overwhelming sense. I've been trying to figure out this identity question with Professor Namsi Kim out of University of Wisconsin about the kind of cultural origin that we define ourselves as actually Vietnamese. You know, how can you say we're Vietnamese if for hundreds of years we are thinking and writing and communicating in Chinese? How can the world deny the fact that we come from Chinese heritage? We are the Chinese, right? We're southern states of the Chinese. Okay, but because I'm talking to you, this really illuminates this question. The minute you become your own method, your own form of communication, this is when you begin to transition into becoming Vietnamese. This is my argument for this very question, is when this guy shows up on the scene. I am going to say, guys, we are no longer Chinese. We don't think in it. We don't write in it. We don't print in it. We are transitioning. And the crazy thing is, it took the French Portuguese missionaries to kind of transition us out of becoming Chinese. Yeah. So we are an amalgamation of the West and the East. And we are a true fusion culture that has come. And I am like, today I'm blown away with this realization. I feel like I'm like 49 years old when I just realized, okay, wait, here's the answer to the really wretched question I've had for 5 years now. I've been searching for this question. When people are like fighting back that we are, you know, I have family members like, we're not Chinese, we're Vietnamese. I'm like, okay, so when did that happen? Nobody can give me an answer. Now I can really plant the flag and say, guys, this is how this happened. This is why we're Vietnamese.
Dave, that was good. I think you're spot on. Now, I want to take this even further here. So, okay, the moment you start constructing your own national language, Quốc ngữ, you are in essence creating the nation. But you have to go further, according to Pham Quyên. For Pham Quyên, it's not even enough to construct a national language. You need to draw attention to literature, your nation's famous literature. And so he has a lot to say about The Tale of Gyu by Nguyễn Du. So this was a poem published in the early 19th century. And he's doing this to generate national pride and confidence. By the way, shameless plug in... an episode of Nam Phong Dialogues, my podcast with Yin Vu, we discuss The Tale of Gyu. So listeners, you're encouraged to listen to that.
Can I quickly ask you about The Tale of Gyu real quick?
Yeah.
Is that written in Han Viet? Was it written in Chinese Vietnamese at the time, way preceding the Quốc ngữ, right?
Oh yeah, you said it was not written in Quốc ngữ, yeah.
So it's all based in real, like, Chinese words that became Vietnamese?
Yeah, so, well, one thing we should mention here is that the story, the novel, was based on a Chinese story. But Pham Quyên is going to say, Nguyễn Du, what he does is he takes this Chinese story and he makes it even better. So... He's going to praise it and say that the more one studies The Tale of Gyu, the more one feels its perfection, the full and harmonious perfection of a work of art that completely achieves an ideal of beauty that corresponds not to a particular aesthetic, but to the very pattern and rhythm of universal art. So he has so much to say about that. But yes, you're right, Ken. I mean, the Tale of Gyu is full of references also to Chinese philosophy. I mean, it's very deeply Chinese. But Pham Quyên is going to say it's actually the essence of Vietnamese-ness here.
Yeah, I mean, the writer Nguyễn Du, it's a Vietnamese name, but there is lingering There is vestiges of the Chinese language and culture that's happening. I think that's where sort of like it begins to transition into kind of like its own Vietnamese identity at this point, before Quốc ngữ is about to kind of be official in the country.
Yeah, yeah. So at this point, we've been talking about Tham Quyên's Confucianism, his language building project. And I want to turn to how he views the relationship between Vietnam and France, because we have to keep in mind that the French are dominating the Vietnamese. How does Tham Quyên react to this? Now, he's going to acknowledge that colonial violence had created this degrading relationship between the French and the Vietnamese. And what he does in his journal is he's also going to exhort the French. He's going to tell the French, look, you need to adopt a policy of respect, politique d'égard. And so he's going to say, I actually find this part quite amusing and funny, because he says these things to the French where he's basically trying to flatter them. He's going to say, look, French people, you're better than all the other Europeans. The Frenchman, I'm quoting, is not as imperialistic as the English, not as chauvinistic as the Italians, not as militaristic as the Germans, not as exploitative as the Americans. Rather, the French represent the best that Western civilization has produced. And then he goes on to say, what are you amazing French people going to do with these conquered people, us? Are you going to be content to dominate and exploit us as a vulgar colonizer does? No, because that's not your strength. It would be infinitely better for you to follow your natural inclination and let this broad humanism within you, eager to spread for the greater good of all humanity, act freely. Like, it's really funny because he's basically saying, look, you're so much better than this. Why are you doing this? You know?
But, you know, he's not wrong. He's not wrong. I mean, the analysis is kind of spot on when you bring in the Germans, the Americans, the Brits, you know,
he's trying to guilt the French into realizing, oh yeah, wait, we do have all these principles and maybe we should live up to them. And I found this part interesting. He says, quote, if I reasoned like a Chinese philosopher, I would say that the East is the principle yin and the West the principle yang. One represents perenniality and stability, the other strength and activity. So far, they have not met each other, having developed each in their own pole. However, their meeting may one day produce a more beautiful form of civilization for humanity, harmonious, more humane, and more perfect. Okay, this is really interesting because, well, first off, a modern reader such as myself, if I'm reading this, this is obviously, one could say, very problematic, because what it does is it essentializes the East and the West. First off, there's really no such thing as the East or the West, and you're kind of endowing these concepts with essences. Like the East is, like Asians are stable, or, you know, they have this essence, and the West is this. This is a form of Orientalism. And it could be problematic. So Edward Said is a famous post-colonial theorist, and he's going to say the Europeans have used this exact characterization of Asia and the East as being stagnant in order to justify the West's its domination over the East. Now, Tham Quyên is doing something similar in his characterization of the East and West, but he's not trying to dominate anybody. I think that's the difference. He's actually trying to promote a kind of harmony and a balance where there's no domination, but he's still giving the East and West the essence. All right.
You know, we got a real good peek into Tham Quyên's life, and I think there's obviously a lot more here. Shameless plug for your book, The Architects of Dignity. We can find the link in the description below, and we have covered 5 of the 6 of the characters, right? Am I wrong? Am I on there?
We've covered
4 or 5.
Yeah, 4 so far.
We're missing 2 more. Okay.
We're missing
2 more. And the next episode that we're doing next is something that Kevin and I have been really going over to figure out how much trust do we need to build up between everybody that's listening to this podcast subseries, Vietnamese History Makers, to introduce Ho Chi Minh, because he is a polarizing figure in the diaspora and in the homeland. And I think that to some people, all of these figures are related, but really the tip of the spear is really here at Ho Chi Minh. So a little bit more about that, Kevin?
Well, I'll just add and say that Ho Chi Minh is controversial in the sense that his name evokes disagreement among Vietnamese all over the world. But Ho Chi Minh is not a controversial figure, of course, in Vietnam.
Right.
There's no controversy there. But Ho Chi Minh is this figure that is potentially divisive given the history of civil wars between Vietnamese people. And so what we're going to do, and I really look forward to that episode, the next episode on Ho Chi Minh, is we're going to sidestep these political minefields, I hope, by focusing on writings that are attributed to Ho Chi Minh. That's what I would like to do. So how did Ho Chi Minh understand himself and his world? Okay, so instead of saying he was good or bad, I don't really want to talk, but I want to understand how he understood himself. I mean, what do you think about that goal? Do you think that's a good goal, Ken?
Yeah, I think that's what we aspire to do in all of our episodes. We don't talk good. We don't talk bad. We bring up things that are present in the facts. And I think that after Ho Chi Minh, we would probably want to do some of the generals that followed up behind him. We would want to talk about people on the South government side that were existing in the same time frame, like President Thiel. I think all of these figures bring a certain sort of history to the Vietnamese people in the entire on the entire planet, and why these people are significant to the creation of the modern Vietnamese. And I think these are wonderful topics to talk about if you can remove the good, the bad, and just sort of bring in the thinking side of who these figures were.
Yeah. Well said.
Kevin, thank you so much again for bringing game to the podcast. I love it. I love these discussions.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trin. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast. At Verizon, anyone can trade in their old phone for a new one on us with Unlimited Ultimate, which means everyone in your family could get a new phone and stay on your family plan, keeping you close.
Hey, Mom, you seen my toothbrush?
Yeah, I'm almost done with it.
Oh, maybe too close. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.